We made this.
Hello and welcome to We Buy Records. I'm Paul Field and I'm joined very early in the morning for us by the lovely Tim Scullion in his Zen Lounge. Morning, Tim.
Hi, Paul. I would definitely normally still be asleep right now. So well done. You got me out of my lair. Yeah, well done.
And into your lovely Zen Lounge, as I like to call it.
It's nice, isn't it, my Zen Lounge?
I missed recording in there.
I know, I'm sorry.
They had a really nice ambience.
It was better episodes, wasn't it, when it was recorded in here?
Well, that's not about the content. It was more about the vibe.
Yeah, but the vibe created better content, Paul.
Maybe. Right, let's crack on. Let's do some housekeeping.
Okay.
A quick thank you to coffee supporters. David McElroy, thank you very much. Anon. I've never had an Anon before.
Oh,
so
thank you
Anon. And thank you to Paul Coughlin.
And thank you also to Adam Buckland, Tom Berry and Gavin Hogg. Thank you so much, guys. It really, really helps and we genuinely appreciate it.
Thank you so much. A little follow-up housekeeping here, Tim. Now, last episode, we caused quite a stir when we highlighted in our quiz the rather kind of bizarre Discog seller who was A, charging incredibly high prices and B, using some rather flowery language and very long, verbose descriptions of all of his practices around selling.
The other day, I was reminded of him doing most of his listing in the winter months, and I chuckled to myself, Paul.
If anyone has no idea what we're talking about, I do apologise, but on this occasion, you will have to go back to the last episode and listen to the quiz at the end.
It's worth it.
Yeah, quite a lot of our listeners, Tim, went onto Discogs and found out who it was. And we've got quite a lot of replies, most of them just like head in hand, just aghast, and then pointing out even more and more bizarre things. So what I thought it was only fair to do was to inquire about one of his items.
Right.
Now, it was the Stone Roses, you know, the one with the embossed lettering.
Yes.
Yep. I think, what's that go for now? Is it like 80 quid or something?
It's in the last sort of 3 or 4 years, it's like doubled in value because I'm sure it was only a sort of 35 quidder. Mm-hmm. And now I've seen some people asking over 100 for it. But I think now it's, yeah, you should be kind of happy if you get it for 65, 70
quid,
I think, for a really nice copy.
Well, he had one for £1,500. Right. And if you were going to spend that kind of money, you'd want to ask a few questions in advance. Correct?
Of course you would.
So I wrote to him and said, hello, I'm missing this variant from my collection. Would you be so kind as to send photos and also, if possible, photos of the packaging you would use? Because if you remember, he uses plywood.
He does.
Can you specifically highlight the scuff? It is listed as near mint, but it does have a scuff. Are you also...
No, no.
Yes. No, no, yes, I know that, and you know that, but he doesn't.
It says it's near mint, but it has a scuff.
Yes. Are you also able...
In that case, Paul, in that case, the High Lamas record that you bought me as a gift, that is therefore still near mint, even though I managed to scuff it within about 10 minutes of getting it.
Right. I went on to... And this is perfectly reasonable, would you say, so far?
Completely for 100. What was it? For £1,500.
And I closed by saying, are you also able to confirm that when you play tested this item, there are no audio issues in the affected area? Yep. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. And lastly, has the item been professionally cleaned? And if so, how?
Brilliant, Paul.
I mean, there is nothing taking the mickey or silly in there. That seems perfectly reasonable. Would you like to hear his reply?
Did he say, I'm afraid I only reply in the winter months?
I'm happy to send photos of the record and the plywood spacers, but will need your email address to do so. Which country are you in? And I can research Royal Mail postage service options for you. International tracked and signed with appropriate insurance cover. The only problem is that I think I may be out of the specially cut LP sized plywood spacers.
Oh no.
Disaster already, Tim. Here's why though. Aberdeen City, where I live, is currently back in lockdown, which means I can only travel up to 5 miles from home until at least next Wednesday. Although various B&Qs have reopened, there have been no one manning the cutting machines. I have been in two stores on at least two occasions each, and there was no one there. Due to the Health and Safety Act, B&Q will no longer cut them to size, suitable for 7-inch singles. Fortunately, I have kept some suitable wood, perhaps too large, from my old kitchen, which has been replaced. This might wow. suffice as a suitable substitute. There are thin centrepiece rectangles from the kitchen doors that might be slightly large. There may be size limits with Royal Mail Postal Services. It is dependent upon where I am sending the package. I also have the base of the drawers, which is probably an ideal size. This is one example why the proposed forcing of sellers to quote standard shipping rates up front doesn't really work in the UK, and there is a huge rebellion on by Discog sellers. It is to be enforced on the 1st of October 2020 and means for every record in every country, you need to specify a price and manually maintain them as prices change. I seriously doubt I will be able to accurately photograph the scuff on the black vinyl unless you can suggest some method I can try. One option might be to have a video conference and try and let you see it somehow. Happy to set that up any time today if it suits. I can send you a link to connect
Paul.
To Facebook, Zoom, or any other video chat service. Otherwise, I could perhaps try and describe it.
Please tell me that you did a video chat with him.
No, I did not. Because you'll find out why shortly. You know, I asked him to play test it.
Yes.
I have never play tested this item. It is my brother's record. He is the one careful owner and now lives in Australia. Before he and his wife emigrated in 1994, my brother donated his record collection to me as described in my Discogs profile. The record has not been played since. Although I own a turntable, I no longer own a working amp. So I'm afraid I have no means of play testing records. Sorry, sold as seen.
Flip.
Lastly, has the item been professionally cleaned? No, the item has never been cleaned.
Discogs kind of needs to, don't they, investigate this dude?
Tim, I got another message soon afterwards. I've just got the record out. I'm sorry to say, this is not an embossed sleeve.
Oh my God.
I'm not sure what made me think it was when I first registered the record. Perhaps they have been moving and merging releases on the database. I can only apologise. Sorry to have wasted your time. FYI, as far as marks on the record, there are a couple of extremely light surface scratches that would never affect play. They would have been hard to photograph. I will move mine to the other release with 10 for sale. Hope to find you the copy you are looking for. So it had scratches on it.
And it wasn't the copy that he listed.
But apart from that, another successful Discogs sale there almost. Wow.
Shall we talk about Record Store Day?
I suppose so. So in lieu of a standard news... here is our Record Store Day news roundup.
Well, we sent you out on a field trip, Tim.
Yes, I got, I think it's the first time in many years that I actually went out in the morning. I went to a shop, I got there, the shop opened at 8 a.m. I got there at 7:40 or 7:35, something like that, which I appreciate is not particularly early. The queue wasn't very big at all. But there was one little group that had been camping from 9 p.m. the night before, and they brought a little tent, which that was nice. I got into the shop at about 9:15, and I managed to get the two items that I wanted, which was a Guided by Voices 10-inch reissue of a late 90s EP and a reissue of the 1964 album Folk Roots, New Roots by Shirley Collins and Davy Graham. So shall I paint you a sort of picture of how it was set up this year?
Yeah, please.
So because of COVID-19, there was a strict one customer or one bubble So I was there with a friend and we were both allowed in, but one at a time policy. And as a consequence, there was not really any time for mooching or dawdling. You had to go in. They had the records in boxes behind them. You had to tell them what you wanted. Now, they provided a printout of the list with prices, and they gave it out to you in the queue, which was very good. So you could sort of be ready to say, right, I want this, this, and this. So it was fine to say, I want this, and have you still got it? And they would say yes or no. But the problem was, for them, I should say, not for me, the problem for, and this will be true of all the shops across the board, normally on record store day, this shop actually told me, because I asked them, the ratio of record store day stock sold and normal stock sold is normally about 60% record store day stock and 40% shop stock. So people come in, maybe buy some record store day bits and then treat themselves to a recent release that they missed or something that they didn't realize had come out. Because don't forget, some people, this is their one time they go into a record shop. And they're like, oh, and there's a new Granddaddy record. Great. And they buy that as well. This year, it was 100% record store day purchases and 0% anything else purchases. So actually, that's really bad for shops. Really bad.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's a really good point.
Yeah. So it's, thanks a lot, COVID. Obviously, there's nothing that we can do about it. We are where we are at the moment, but it kind of sucks. It's not a day for hanging out and treating yourself to a few bits and then looking again. It's a day for in, look, buy, go.
I mean, looking online, obviously, I tweeted about Record Store Day and asked the listeners how their day went. And most people seem to get everything they want, regardless of how they went about it. So those that queued got their stuff. Those that popped along during the day got their stuff. And for the most part, and there was a lot of kind of community helping out here, when all the rest of the stock went live at 6 o'clock, most people seemed to get stuff from that they wanted then as well.
Although I heard there was a lot of horror stories about crashing websites.
Yes. I think there weren't a huge number of titles that were particularly tricky to get. However, there were some.
Okay.
And I've looked online to see what was selling for big money. Top of the Pops was the Kylie 12-inch.
Really?
£255 top price paid for that. It is on Discogs for £70. That was obviously someone went a bit early, but I've seen many, many copies of that selling for way over the top. It was Giorgio Moroder and Kylie. It was on, so it's an older single that's been on vinyl for the first time.
Wow.
Duran Duran, really popular, that one.
What?
Yep. That is regularly going for over 200. Your face. And Sun Ra, £180. but here's the thing, right? It's few and far between, and there's not huge volumes of them. There's a very small number of high, whereas normally there's bloody hundreds of these things selling for hundreds of pounds, but it's literally the odd one. Most of them on eBay, they're being flipped for double or whatever, but it's not, there's no massive profit for the flippers. And one of the most popular items isn't even a Record Store Day 2020 item.
Right.
It's the St. Etienne album. Sellers have obviously held on to those from
Love Record Stores.
Yep. Rebadged them as Record Store Day 2020. And I've seen several copies going between 130 and 150. Badged as Record Store Day. Isn't that mad?
Yes.
One of the most popular items sold wasn't even a Record Store Day item.
But if that's been re-stickered as Record Store Day...
No. Relabeled on eBay in the description.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's terrible.
I know. I mean, bloody chances, eh? They'll try anything to squeeze a few quid out. So some poor saps thought, oh, there was a St. Etienne for Record Store Day. I didn't know that. Can't find it anywhere. Thought, oh, well, that must be the only copy. Left and paid out £150.
Oh, my God.
But overall, flipping activity way, way, way down.
Well, I think that ties in with the general, awareness of Record Store Day is way down this year. So I've been sort of conducting my own poll in our shop and online, on sort of forums and Facebook, and in asking the shop. And, you know, my question is, I normally sort of say, did you know that it's Record Store Day in 2 weeks? And then, did you know that it's Record Store Day in a week? And then, did you know that it's Record Store Day on Saturday? And so many people have said, oh, no, okay. Or they've said, yeah, whatever. There have been pretty few people that have been up to speed on the list and sort of talking about, normally, you know, once the list has come out and as you get a bit closer, the conversation is usually, oh yeah, there's not much on it, but I really fancy this, this, and this. This year, the answer has almost always been, oh, what do you think of that? You weren't fussed about it, were you?
No, because there was nothing I wanted. Well, there was like a couple of 12 inches, but there was no way I was paying that price for an existing £1 item, if you see what I mean. Even there was one new mix. So if you're buying an album for 23 quid, but if you're spending £16-17 on a 12 inch to get one track, that is a terrible value.
It's not ideal.
I will say, on Saturday when it's Record Store Day, my partner Catherine said, oh, I didn't even know it was today. How could you not know? She goes, because you didn't mention it on the last episode.
This is very true. And doesn't that tell you something about how...
And do you know why we didn't mention it? Because we forgot.
Crazy, isn't it?
It was as simple as that.
But it's a double thing, because one of the reasons why we forgot is because nobody else has been talking about it. So we Correct. Didn't get reminded.
No, I mean, we have a really busy Twitter feed with people talking about records and tagging us into everything all the time, every mm-hmm. single day. Sometimes we'll get, you know, 50, 60, 70 replies to something. But we haven't had hardly anything about Record Store Day in the run-up. I will say there were some very polarizing opinions about it this time. It's almost become like this Brexit divide of those that, you know, enjoy it, but the ones who are anti it are becoming a lot more anti.
If it's like Brexit, which side are the leavers and which side are the remainers, Paul?
Well, I don't think there are. It's not for us to decide on that.
No, fair enough.
But it is. I have noticed a shift in tone, certainly from the negative side. You know, we've said many, many times, Tim, we are a broad church here, and we are interested and open to talk about any kind of record buying.
Paul, going back to flippers,
mm?
I met one in the wild. I met a flipper, Ooh. And I got to grill him.
Ooh, I didn't know this.
Well, so it was in our shop, and he was pretty much the only person who seemed interested in Record Store Day when I brought it up. And I mentioned to him, oh, but you know, the bloody flippers. And he said, oh, well, I buy some things to flip. And so I pushed him. So this is what he said. The headline is, he's a very unrepentant flipper, actually. And his logic is, well, there were two main planks to his argument, Paul. And let's see if they win you over. Number one, the items that he flips pay for the items that he actually wants. Okay, you're looking stony-faced. And number two, you'll like this one. The people that are happy to pay exorbitant prices online were too lazy to queue at the shop on the morning, and rich enough, obviously, to be able to afford to pay those high prices. So it's fine.
So what you're saying is that rich people should be in a position to displace your regular Joe from getting a copy of a record.
Yes.
Yes, that's not a great argument, is it?
When he was putting it in his own words, I was almost convinced. And then I pictured the tragic Tiny Tim character who was one behind him in the queue, who did queue up on the day and couldn't get the thing he wanted because this guy had bought the last copy purely to flip to a rich person.
I mean, that literally happened to me last year with the 808 box set.
Really?
Yeah. Those local flippers who I understand were not in attendance this year due to an illness.
I don't want to say it's karma, Paul, because that would be...
It's karma.
Yeah, so normally, listeners, there are two local guys who sort of do the rounds, and they, you know, they'll pop up at a different one maybe each year, and then maybe whiz on to the next one as well so they can hit a few. And they're very... they're a very recognisable pair, let's say. They cut a dash, don't they, Paul?
Oh, yes.
But yeah, they were conspicuous by their absence, and the rest of the queue, I think, was celebrating.
That's glorious. That's it. Record Store Day, done and dusted for another year, although it's not, because there's two more drops
there's
to come.
There's two more. When I went to the shop, local shop that was doing it, I did ask them, so is it three smaller things? Because there seems to be a lot of stuff. And they said, the next two are going to be quite small in comparison. Basically, this is the day. This is where most of the stuff has been released. So I don't really understand what the point of there being two more little ones is.
No.
Something else actually they said was that I asked them how much stock they'd got this year compared to previous years. And they said that it was only about a quarter less than previous years that they'd ordered in.
Oh, okay.
They said we're down by about a quarter on what we would normally order. So still a big day. And I think that the shops have still done really well out of it. But it's definitely hurt the fact that people aren't also buying non-Record Store Day items when they go in, because they're in a rush and because the next person has to come in because of COVID-19. That's the real bummer of the year, I think. There we go, Record Store Day.
Tim, we've got a letter bag this week. We have two Discogs questions. Nigel Poor, he wants to know about starting out on Discogs. I think he's got some surplus records, private collector. He just wants to sell a few on. It is tricky, isn't it? Because a lot of people won't buy from someone with no feedback. I'm trying to remember my first sale. I think what I did was one of the items was a dance record that people would really wanted, and I put it in at a good price, and someone took a punt. I mean, I could have asked you to buy one of my records, I guess, because you know and trust me. I mean, you could go down that road, because once you have one feedback, you should be okay. We are talking here about someone who's legitimate and genuine and wants to actually sell the records. We're not trying to help scammers here.
No, I mean, I've got a few thoughts on that.
Go on.
Well, one is basically what you just said, which is price them well, and then people will buy them because they'll think, okay, it's a new seller, but you know, the price is good. People will risk it if the price is good, I think. Number two, make sure that you grade them correctly. If you can, say, go to a local record shop or record fair or a dealer that you know and sort of say, right, here's 10 records, here's the grade I think that each of them are, would you please also grade them, and let's see if I've nailed it. And I think that can be a really, really quick way, because things will occur to the dealer that haven't occurred to you, and they'll say, ah, right, okay, you can't call that near mint because of this. Ah, okay, right, I see, noted. Or they'll say, you've called that VG because of this fingerprint, but actually that's near mint, just wipe off the fingerprint. And it's things that you very, very quickly learn this stuff. So get the grading right. And then my third top secret tip is there, and I think I've said this before on the pod, there is a notes field where you can write comments. Demonstrate to potential buyers that you are not a fucking idiot, and briefly talk about the item and explain why you have graded it the way that you have graded it. For example, if you think it's near mint, you can say, beautiful near mint copy, played once or twice, no signs of use, but it's been handled and it has been played, but it's a really gorgeous copy from my own collection. That goes such a long way. When you see those sellers that have got loads of items and they just put near mint or VGVG and zero notes, and I think, I am not going to buy a VGVG copy of someone who hasn't even bothered to kind of think of it as putting your mind at rest. Those notes are to put the buyer's mind at rest, and I think they are sorely underused on Discogs. So if you are someone who uses them, I think you'll go far.
Yep. I mean, I can't stress that Tim's last point enough. That is definitely the way to sell stuff. And if you're a new seller, that is 100% the best way that you are going to get people to buy your items, by using that descriptor box, which is viewable publicly.
But obviously don't lie in it.
We've got kind of a follow-up question here from Phil. He says he's going to be sort of selling his records almost on a full-time basis following a redundancy. He wants to know, where's the best place to look for new stock? Well, I don't think there's going to be anything earth-shattering here. But, I mean, for me, the ones that spring to mind, but everyone else is using them, are things like eBay. If you Spock can be good. I ended up with effectively paying like 100 quid for my guy's whole dance collection, and he threw in stacks and stacks of free records, including all those weird Pink Floyd records that I ended up giving to you.
And he gave you his car?
No, he didn't, but it was such a weird... It was just a guy who was local, had loads of records to clear, and I ended up with thousands of records for no money. And when I went through them, there were, you know, like 30, 40 quid dance records in there. Bingo, wow. Banco. Boot fares. I mean, you've got to be lucky. Again, I think we told this story on the podcast where I bought a DJ's collection from his scorned girlfriend, who took the whole lot to a boot fair for £50 for the best part of 500 12 inches.
Oh my God.
And again, including loads of hard to find 90s bangers in that £20 to £40 range. I mean, it took me months to get rid of them. Yeah. And charity shops, when they've got a lot of, you'll sometimes see large volume of stock, especially if a DJ dropped his collection off. This happened to me in Shelter in Eastbourne. A DJ had dropped off all of the records that had been sent to him for free over the years. There were probably 700 or 800. Because it was a charity, I said, look, you could be here till doomsday selling these for £1 each. I'll make you an offer. And I think I offered her 250 quid. She went, really? Done. I'll take it. And I managed to take away the whole lot. And again, once I went through them, of course, there were loads of, you know, really nice items in there. There were loads that were worth 50p, but there was enough. The charity had a win and I had a win. So don't be afraid to make an offer on stuff, even in a charity shop.
Agreed. Also, Facebook Marketplace is very hit and miss, and a lot of people selling complete rubbish Val Dunican records and asking 50 quid for 6 black and white minstrels and stuff. So there's a lot of rubbish on there, but if you're willing to look several times a day to pick stuff up, that there is, I've got good stuff on Facebook Marketplace. Friends of mine have as well, so that's another place to look. It raises the point that about getting new stock and getting good stuff, it's not easy. And we've all been to a newly opened record shop that had brilliant stuff in it, because that was the collection that the shop owner had built up over their lifetime. And then you go again a year later and either it's exactly the same or all the good stuff has gone and it's been replaced with 80s Rod Stewart albums and stuff. So it's not easy, and we see time and time again that it's not easy. And maybe sometimes the answer is paying a fair price for used records, because those shops maybe that are less willing to pay a fair price end up only ever getting good stuff because they were lucky, whereas places that have got a good reputation for buying collections for a fair price, people will actively choose to go to those shops and not the other shops. I know it's different for this guy because he's on Discogs, but I still think there's something to it. You know, if you are not trying to get stuff for the most disgusting bargain, sort of rip off a granny, if you go into it the spirit of, I want to pay a fair price for a job lot, which is obviously way less than an individual price, but nevertheless a fair price for a collection, and then I'll do the work, I'll sell it on. But what it doesn't mean is that I offered you 20 quid for an amazing collection. So I think karma, or it's, you know, what goes around comes around. So that's another thing to consider, is trying to be a fair, scrupulous, honest dealer, I think will go a long way.
Brilliant.
Well, and this is what we've happened. People tell a friend.
Yeah. Word of mouth is really important.
Really important.
Just going to finish the last little letter here from Jason Shepherd. He's been telling us about his travels around the record shops of the Northwest and the Midlands, Blackpool, etc. But he's getting increasingly annoyed of seeing new records mixed with old records. Now, what do you think about this, Tim?
Yeah, we do it a little bit, but I agree. It is inherently, I think it is annoying, because you'll be looking in the indie section and you'll find a Charlatans record. And you go, oh, wow, great, a 90s. Oh, no, it's the reissue.
Oh, yes, of course.
You would never have that heart-fluttering moment if they were kept separate.
I see it all the time. I don't care that much either way. I guess it would make life easier if they were separate, but I don't have a massive issue if they're not. But you are right. You could get hooked into thinking there was an original in there when it's a reissue, especially if they've taken the cellophane off.
If they've taken the cellophane off and they're selling it at a used price,
mm-hmm.
then I think that's totally fine.
Yeah, it's fair enough, isn't it?
But I mean, we, you know, obviously the shop I run with my partner is brilliant. We would always write on the label the year if it's a reissue. If it's come in to us secondhand, the very idea of not indicating this is a reissue from this year, you'd have to be a real shitbag, wouldn't you, to like put in a Smiths record and not point out actually this is the reissue from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, no, you would have to be. But we've seen all sorts of dodgy practices, so it wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't put it past someone to try it or to deliberately do that.
People are awful.
They are. Well, thank you everyone for your letters. If you want to get in touch with us, drop us a line to webuyrecordspod@gmail.com.
Paul, I believe you've had a cracking confession.
I have. Should we do the thing?
Yeah.
Paul's Confessional Corner.
In my first few weeks of a Christmas job at HMV 363 Oxford Street, an old dude came up to the counter and asked if we had the new PJ Proby single, to which I replied with the overconfidence of youth, "I think you'll find he died years ago." He just looked at me and said, "Oh," and then walked off. Then my manager Pete leaned over and said quietly, "You've just told PJ Proby he's dead." This still haunts me.
Are you serious?
Yes. He did go on to tell me that he thought he'd asked for the single. It was "Love Will Tear Us Apart." I think it's a cover. And until I think yesterday, he didn't believe it even existed. Until here it is. It does exist. I found it on Discogs. It was released in 1985 by PJ Proby.
Not a cover of Joy Division.
Well, it's called "Love Will Tear Us Apart."
Oh, PJ Proby. Oh, I'm so heartbroken.
Yeah, he told PJ Proby to his face that he was dead.
We're going to struggle to get a better confession than that, aren't we?
Probably.
In Paul's Confessional Corner.
Oh, your face has lit up like a Christmas tree. He's still alive. He's still with us, by the way, Mr. Proby. So he was trying to kill him in 1985.
But he's clung on.
He's clung on. If you're listening, PJ,
we love you.
Yes.
Stay alive.
Tim, well, I've been talking to Gareth James. Now, we've had lots of questions about this. I see it online all the time, about people talking about the quality of vinyl pressings in this day and age. And it's just, I don't have the ears for it. I don't really, unless they're really extreme, I'm not able to discern between a really good, or did you see what I mean? For the most part, it just doesn't sound the same to me. And
as long as it's got a load of hi-hats and a kick drum, you're like, yep, sounds great.
Well, as I said to Gareth, I think in recent history, I've only noticed it a couple of times where one's been amazing or a record's been bad. Everything else to me is just kind of in the middle. However, Gareth is an expert. He reviews albums, LPs for Clash magazine, and we're going to have a little chat with him now.
I'm one of those sort of slightly unusual people who got into vinyl as vinyl was sort of dying out the first time round. So it was my sixth birthday when my dad bought me one of those Stacker turntable things that I think he'd picked up very cheap somewhere. And I would just pick up reduced 7-inch singles and start buying sort of like X jukebox 7-inches that used to be in like the department stores for 60p each and things like this. So the Top of the Pops 89 repeats that have been on recently, that was basically my era of buying old X jukebox 7s for about sort of a year when I was 6 or 7, and just got obsessed with them. You know, all the things that everybody has about loving vinyl, all the people that listen to this I'm sure have those same sort of reasons for loving vinyl, but that was me as a really young kid. So all my sort of early pop singles albums I was buying on vinyl, even though at that point, it was 80s turning to the start of the 90s was the big push on CD. So all my kind of pop shame happens through that era. So, you know, I was the person buying a New Kids on the Block album on vinyl when I was 7 or 8. And then I sort of came out the other side when Woolies were clearing out all their sevens and vinyl and just sort of moving to CDs and saying, chuck your 7 inches in a bin and all that sort of stuff. But I stayed with it till I was about sort of 12 or 13. So when the Britpop battles happened and everything, Oasis and Blur, I was the sort of one person in the record shop under the age of about 40 buying that on vinyl. And I got the funny looks for it as well. You could tell that they were humouring me because obviously I was spending money on records, but I think they genuinely thought, who the hell's this? Why is there a 12-year-old buying The Great Escape on vinyl? And then we sort of turned in the noughties, went to university and thought, actually, no, I'm gonna stick with it. I'd sort of flirted with CDs, as we all do, and then just sort of got back into it. So while I did miss probably the optimal period to be buying vinyl, if you want to sort of get a mortgage out of it, I was back by the sort of start of the noughties.
You're kind of, one of your hats now is to review the vinyl albums for Clash magazine. And I know a particular bugbear of yours is the quality of the pressings. So, but let's take a little step back and cover a little bit of the history of pressings. Now, I only have two things on my mind, that most of our records either come from the Czech Republic or France, but I'm not sure how true that is or where that fits in the timeline. So hopefully you can kind of talk us through, maybe just from the 70s onwards, just to paint a picture of what that landscape was like.
I mean, you're not far off. Certainly the Czech Republic's a big player in all of this. There is a big plant in France as well. But I mean, really, if you're thinking back to sort of the period once rock and roll changed the way people consume music, and then you get into the proper LP and the notion of singles and vinyl like that, once you get out of the 60s, there was obviously a massive uptake in spend and disposable income. So lots of listeners will be familiar with picking up Dynaflex records that were a big thing for like RCA Victor from sort of the end of the 60s. They tried it for about 5 years. They're the ones that you can sort of wobble and shake like a sheet of paper. And, you know, they're not great. Some people argued that they sounded a little bit better, but they didn't tend to sort of hold up particularly well. I mean, they were brought in to stop all the breakages with the more stiff records before. And then essentially from that sort of mid-70s point through to the sort of mid-80s, there was a reasonably strong, you know, vinyl pressing scene. It was in its pomp. It continued. You know, when you pick up a lot of those old records, they still sound incredible. Clean them up and they'll sound as good as anything. And then towards the end of the 80s, obviously the CD boom was coming in. Vinyl still held its own. I mean, the really weird bit is when you look back at the cost of those pressings. So if you ever dig up an old copy of the NME or whatever and look in the back page, and you'll see that even early 90s, the CD was $12.99 and the LP and the tape was $6.99 each. And so there was just availability, pressing plants, everything. It was dead easy to do. As we move into the start of the 90s, obviously CD takes over. The shops say, we're not stocking this anymore. And so you end up with these much more kind of niche operations. So lots of pressing plants closed, lots of them scaled down. You know, they didn't bother training up new people to do pressing. So you lose all that expertise. You had all these people that were doing it, and normally you just pass that from generation to generation. But if you've decided that format's worthless, you just let it die out. So you had fewer and fewer plants, and you know, in sort of, you get a lot of those popular indie titles of the 90s. If it was an act that cared about vinyl, they could get a beautiful version done. You know, it comes down to really sort of tiny details, like things like Morning Glory, which, you know, there have been like 200 different versions of, and you can get it in Sainsbury's for £15 on vinyl or whatever. The original version of that, people care about specific pressings done through Demont and all this sort of stuff. They were, you know, it's being done really, really well. But as interest slipped, standards slipped, and, you know, people will say to you, there was a lot of fairly terrible vinyl starting to crop up at the end of the 90s, early noughties, as the odd bits were just being flung out and it was being sold in such a kind of niche way nobody really cared. And then it all changed again towards the end of the noughties. I mean, Record Store Day as a thing in the UK really started in 09, but then 2010 was the year of the Blur 7-inch and all the things that kind of sort of brought it to people's attention. And it was from that point onwards, you got, you know, every year we get the same pieces in the BBC and, you know, on the entertainment programmes, the One Show sends Giles Brandreth to go and, you know, ferret through a charity shop and hold up no parlay. They do that every year now. And so there's been this kind of 10-year regrowth. And so the plants that stuck around and you know, you mentioned earlier, just to go back to that, you know, your big ones are GZ is the one in the Czech Republic that you mentioned, and we'll come on to them later. You've got MPO is the French one that you're talking about, which lots of people recognize from their early 90s indie. If you've got loads of like old 4AD records and things like that, look for the little MPO scratch in the run-out groove. Optimal in Germany along with Palace, and then America was things like United, Who again don't have a great rep, and then Rainbow, who recently closed. So that, you know, what you end up with, Record Industry is another one in the Netherlands. But once you've got this small cluster left, they are pretty much it. So once the revival started, you've got this situation where you need thousands and thousands and thousands of copies of things all the time to fill Sainsbury's and Tesco's and to put 100 reissues in the racks for the HMV sale. But you've still only got 5 or 6 places that are pressing the records for you. So it's become one of these things where every plant is now just running at absolute capacity.
That is an absolutely beautifully brief history. So thank you. And I've learned a lot there. So, and I'm sure the listeners will too. So thank you so much for that. Let's touch upon what's happening now. I know you've become increasingly agitated of late online about pressing qualities. And I think it came to, not so much came to a head, but it came to a lot more people's attention when there was a little note put out by online retailer Boomcat.
Yeah.
Now, we've both got this in front of us here. Do you want to give us a quick flavour, or do you want me to give it a little read?
Yeah, I could pull out a couple of bits. It was really interesting because it's one of those where they clearly, you sort of wonder what's the backstory to this. Like, how bad a day had they been having that made somebody sit down and bash this out? Because it's a screenshot from a Word document. Clearly, it's something that's been poured out and then shared. What I found interesting was that loads of people read it and then shared it with me and said, you must have an interesting opinion on this. So clearly, my sort of reputation as a sort of tedious vinyl quality gnaws precedes me. But the general gist of it, they picked out a couple of things, and it's that classic thing where you say, look, we're not trying to be disrespectful about this, we don't want to be condescending, but, which is never the greatest start to an argument, because it kind of insinuates that whatever follows might be slightly condescending and patronizing. But I mean, the element they're saying is essentially that people expect vinyl to be one thing, and they're trying to say, well, vinyl isn't that. So they were talking about things like the noise floor and the idea that, you know, you're going to hear clicks and pops and there will be background rumbles and things. And if you listen to really quiet music, then maybe vinyl isn't the format for you. They talked about smaller number pressing. So like if you do a sort of run of 250 or 500 copies, then that might impact on it. And they talk about how the fact that they use the phrase, the pressing hasn't bedded down, which again caused some discussion online. And they talked about mastering not being very good, and that sometimes people are just sending off masters that are designed for digital listening. So whether you're streaming on Bandcamp or shoving it in a pair of earpods to take around with you, and then they try and press that onto vinyl. And they sort of talked about mastering quality, and they said, you know, it kind of came to head with, if you don't want to hear any surface noise, there are other formats, you know, buy CDs or downloads, you know. And there's some truth to that, certainly. I don't think anyone listening to this expects every single piece of, every record in their rack, every piece of vinyl to be silent. But I think it put a few noses out of joint, because it sort of implied that if you're buying vinyl in 2020, expect there to be problems with it.
This obviously feeds into them getting a lot of returns.
Yes, exactly. And I did, you know, I did try to discuss it a bit with them on there, and they were very good actually at engaging with people about it. And, you know, the big thing that came out of it that I really agreed with them on was, if you've got a dodgy record, and we're talking new pressings here, obviously, yeah. If you've got a dodgy new record and it's a problem like repeating surface noise on a certain song, or, you know, the sort of weird rustly noise that runs through tracks if they're not being pressed properly, there's no point asking for another copy, because nine times out of 10, every copy they've got in the rack sounds exactly like that, and you're wasting everyone's time. And in that respect, I get it completely. I think they're absolutely on the money. The other bits of it I thought were interesting, because it kind of implied that, you know, if you listen to vinyl, expect lots of noise. And there was a comment about, you know, sometimes, you know, high-end or audiophile cartridges can be part of the problem. And you sort of think, it's an odd decision to turn to, because Boomcat, let's be honest, they're not selling top 40 stuff here. They are a specialist retailer.
Very specialist.
And those of us that use them, you know, we know what sort of excellent stuff they stock. But as a result of that, they're probably attracting people who've got racks full of vinyl and a half decent setup at home. I thought it was an interesting argument to sort of come back and say, oh, it might be that your equipment's too good for the records that you're buying from us.
The only time I've ever come across questions about vinyl quality was when I think I had a spare copy of a Garbage album and I put it on Discogs, and someone wrote to me to ask if I would play it to discover whether there was this sibilant S on one of the tracks. There was that, like, and I was thinking, I hate this person already.
And that's what I mean. Like, you get the pros and the cons of it. And you, like, sibilance was that. Like, when I learned what sibilance was, having been a 7-year-old playing these knackered old jukebox 7-inches that were riddled with it, and I used to think, oh, that's a bit annoying, but never mind. And then as I got older and sort of discovered all of that, I understood that some were like that and some weren't like that. But the idea that you can just go around eradicating all of the things that you get from it, it's just nonsense. But, I mean, my line has always been that people always use this Peel quote, you know, well, life has surface noise. And you think, well, yeah, it does. Fair enough. But ultimately, if a record you're paying, and let's face it, we're never much shy of 20 quid these days if you're buying a new album. If you're spending 20 quid plus on a new record, you've probably got the right to expect it to sound pretty good. And yeah. If a record is pressed properly and handled properly and sleeved properly, which is a big part of it, then it should sound quiet. You know, if a record is noisy, it's faulty. Like nobody, when you got a CD, if it skipped or it made a random noise in it, you took it back. You didn't say, oh, well, you know, it's a bit of noise with this format. That's the way of it.
Well, let's talk about what the current situation is. Mm. It has to be one a really kind of extreme for me to notice things around the quality of a record. I use kind of SL1200 decks. They're workhorses. I almost refer to them as agricultural because they will literally play through anything. They're not refined, but if you've got a scruffy looking record, it will cover a multitude of sins, those decks. A couple of albums, though, I have noticed things on. Now, Stefan Bodzin, an album called Powers of Ten, he put that across three bits of vinyl. So effectively, it was one album onto three 12 inches. Yeah. Guess what? It sounded absolutely amazing. At the other end of the spectrum, if Paul A. Taylor from Mute is listening, please turn off, which was Lie Back, The Sound of Music on gold vinyl, which sounds terrible. And for me to notice it sounds terrible, it has to be really bad. So give us what's going on at the moment. What's your take on the current situation?
Well, it's an interesting one because this does tend to sometimes provoke response from people. And, you know, I will say before I say anything, this is all anecdotal. You know, you've seen that there's racks of records behind me, but, I don't think that therefore makes me 100% qualified to speak on behalf of it. It's just my experience of buying, and I do buy a lot of new vinyl. Just speaking from the experience of just going through lots of stuff, and obviously I get sent a fair bit for the column as well, there are certain pressing plants that you get used to knowing. So if you give me a piece of new vinyl, I can tell you where it was pressed within about 3 seconds. So you pass it over to me, I'll have a look in the run out, and I'll be able to tell you. So most people will be used to, you mentioned Czech Republic at the start, there's a very particular type of sort of stamped run out groove that you'll see from a GZ pressing. It always finishes with like a slash A or something like that at the end of a sort of matrix code. They are the kind of go-to plant in the sense that they have been, I mean, they've been rebranded as GZ since about the millennium, but they really did stick it out through the quiet period. Lots of people will recognize sort of early teens, they were branding as GZvinyl.com, like a little stamp, like a little advert in their matrix. But they were bashing them out. And little labels have in the past got cross with me when I've described them as the cheap option, because of course no record pressing option is cheap. Let's be clear about that. But in terms of the relative scale of how things are done, if you go through a company that will, like there's a company called DMS that can find you a place to press your music. So say you've recorded your cover version of No Parlay and you've got all your mates together and you've put together your own version of it. It's Mute inspired. You've referenced all your favorite bands. You're getting it pressed up. You're doing 500 copies that you're going to flog as some merch for the podcast to raise a bit of cash. You go to DMS and say, look, I've got a digital master of this album that I've recorded. I want to press it. What are my options? And they'll give you some options to go for.
They're like a brokerage, effectively.
Exactly, yeah. So if you want to do 500 copies on black vinyl with a simple, like the really staticky cheap paper sleeves, which cause a lot of the problems, it's something like, I think the last time I checked, it's something like 1,290, excluding VAT, to do 500 of those. I mention that number because if you stick an extra 35 quid on, still before VAT, you can have them in polyline sleeves. And those of us listening right now who are used to buying quite a lot of new vinyl will be used to those really cheap paper sleeves that when you can't get the record out, and because they've gone in cheap and they're static, they've drawn all this crap into the grooves when it's been put in the record in what's probably quite a dirty factory. So all that crap is in the groove, then it gets shoved into a cheap paper sleeve, which is static itself when it goes in. How many times have you seen a thumbprint in the sleeve when you're trying to pull the record out in the first place? You pull the record out, those of us who are particularly tedious about this have ways of doing it without, you know, that. But normally you'll pull the record straight out of the cheap paper sleeve and you're probably now moving all of the grit and crap that's on the record back across the record as you pull it out of that paper sleeve. And then you put it on the turntable. And while the music will probably sound pretty decent, you know, it's very rare to get a truly badly pressed sounding record. What you'll potentially get is the static that will take time to subdue, if you can stop it being static in the first place, and then lots of little bits of extra light noise because the record's not been handled particularly well and it's been shoved in a cheap sleeve and so on. So GZ get a lot of criticism online. Like, you know, you don't have to take my word for it on this one. If anybody wants to have a quick look, you'll find out GZ vinyl pressing being moaned about left, right, and centre. They can do it brilliantly, and I really do mean that. where, you know, Demon Records, who reissue a lot of stuff, they've done this for years. They do a lot of 90s indie at the moment, and so I've been reviewing some of their stuff. They tend to make sure the sleeves are a bit bigger so that they're not clingy and they don't stick to the record so much. They clearly take a lot of time checking on the test pressings and stuff, and they tend to be a lot quieter. But if you get it shoved in a cheapo paper sleeve, you're kind of adding a problem. And it's not just GZ that do that. You know, MPO, the French pressing plant, have had lots of criticism for being off-center, which depends on how sensitive your hearing is and how off-center it is as to how much your needle's swinging around and affecting pitch and things like this. I once had a record label, they didn't realize they were doing it, but they mocked me for criticizing off-center on a record that I'd emailed them about. They forgot to delete the chain of emails below my complaint, passed it around the factory, and then a nice customer service person emailed me back about it, and then I read below and I could see someone going, what the hell's this guy talking about? What an idiot. But you'll get those kind of things as well. So it's not immune. I mean, part of the issue is they're all flat out. So when you need to press another 1,000 copies of Rumours so Sainsbury's can have a vinyl sale in December, something's got to give. And so when they're churning out these back-to-black reissues and all the stuff that you see, and, you know, you've done these price comparisons on the pod before about, you know, how much for a new copy reissued and how much for an original, because they're churning them out all the time, quality can suffer. So, I mean, I mentioned Optimal, GZ, MPO, places like that, Record Industry. All of those companies I've had dodgy pressings from in the last 12 months. I will say the majority of my dodgy pressings come from GZ. That's my experience. And plenty of people have said, well, we use them for our little label and they're not a problem. And you know, our customers are happy. And frankly, I'm pleased about that. You know, as a vinyl reviewer, I want people to be happy with their product. But I'm also someone who would like what I buy to sound good as well. So a lot of it is about kind of the corners that are cut sometimes on things like sleeves or checking everything's absolutely sorted. The vinyl mastering is the other issue, though. You know, we're sort of out the other side of obsessive loudness wars in terms of everything being cranked up. But they're still slightly dodgy masters. And Boomcat are absolutely right when they say that if you've got very sort of interesting, quiet music that sometimes will go very dynamic, or you've got textures in the sound, if that's just being bunged across as a digital file that's then being quickly written onto a disc and then pressed, it's unlikely that it's going to sound as good as it might do if that had been carefully done. And, you know, at the risk of being tedious, and do stop me, there's a sort of method called direct metal mastering, which is often referred to as DMM. And you sometimes see it on the fronts of records. So for your sake, I'm just going to hold up one of these right now where you might recognize these labels.
I've got lots of them from Germany.
Yeah, there you go. And it was a big thing early on. It was this Neumann lathe was the big one for that. Optimal have got one as well, I think. GZ used their in-house DMM for it as well. The problem is it can be a shortcut to fairly average sound, because you simply take a digital file and you run it off straight onto the copper plate and then press it from that. And it's not been checked that it can handle a lathe and a proper sort of very dynamic cut. It can work. Some people swear by DMM. They think it sounds great. For the listener's sake, I held up a Björk album just then that is her debut. That goes for over 250 quid now, that pressing, because it's the DMM pressing. And it sounds good, don't get me wrong. And partly that's because it's over four sides rather than two. But people obsess over these things, you know? And so what you've got is a few people left who know how to do a really good lacquer cut using a lathe, make it sound really, really impressive. And then those few people are training a few people. But it's what I said to you, you know, a few minutes ago, that expertise has dwindled and dwindled and dwindled. So we've got smaller and smaller numbers of people that are kind of able to deliver that. So, there, you know, lots of people I talked about vinyl just say that there's too much room for error when you're paying 20, 25 quid an album in 2020. And it unnerves them slightly. If, you know, if you're buying a couple of records a year, that's fine. And that's great. And chances are you'll probably be all right riding the averages. But if you're buying quite a lot, the chances are you're going to find pretty often, you know, there are people on various audiophile forums, so I won't promote by naming them, but they'll talk about how they've had their Amazon Prime account suspended because they've returned so much vinyl in the space of a year. Organizations like that just aren't used to the idea that it could be that dodgy or that faulty, and maybe those people are too picky, I don't know. But my experience is that it's so unpredictable these days.
We've touched upon quite a lot of sinners there. What I'd like to end on, are there any saints in the industry? Are there any small factories where you know if it's come from there, it's going to be a banger?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple. One that is pretty much guaranteed and is a sort of byword for quality across sort of audiophile presence is Palace in Germany. You'll know them because if you look in the matrix, you'll normally see a sort of stamped number with a dash either side of the number. And they'll often say PUSA and things like that. They sort of farm it out through this German plant. That's really good. Optimal are probably the best of the sort of general day-to-day pressings, and they do a lot of them. And you'll see they're sort of hand-carved in the matrix. It always starts with B and then a different letter for each year. So I think they're on BJ at the moment, helpfully, which then just sort of starts off the code on them. And then the other one that those people that buy music on vinyl reissues, this label that does like represses of all the sleeves and the artwork and everything, that's done through a place called Record Industry in the Netherlands, which used to be the sort of Sony plant through the 80s and the 90s for European vinyl. They still have, you know, like Neil Young, I think, swears by Record Industry and Palace. So bearing in mind how nausey he is about his sound quality and how it's the only thing he'll ever talk about, Record Industry and Palace are the kind of two that he swears by. So, I mean, make of that what you will. I don't think we necessarily want to live our lives by the Tower of Neil Young, but as a kind of vinyl thing, those are the two I'd probably pick out.
Thank you ever so much for talking to us, Gareth.
Good, isn't it? He knows his onions.
It's a strong onion game. Thank you.
It's time for the quiz.
I do like a quiz. Paul, seriously, please tell me that it's a fun, happy quiz this time. Please.
Yeah.
I don't think that my blood pressure could have taken it.
It's a very short quiz.
Oh, even better.
Well, I was going to be prepping this quiz this morning. I'm an early bird. And then yesterday evening, one of our listeners said, oh, I've done a quiz for you. Do you mind if I send it in? Yes, please. So Craig Hannington, who presents a weekly Northern Soul radio show on Delight Radio, 10 to midnight on a Friday, he's valued up 5 recent auction sales for Northern Soul records. Yes, Tim.
Oh, man.
So the first one is Kim Weston, I'm Still Loving You on Motown Records. Now, we'll do higher and lower, but it's only a short quiz. But how much do you think that sold for?
Let's be sensible. Let's say it sold for 60 quid.
It was £187.
Wow.
Okay. Next up, Ted Wilson, I Can't Take No More on Sierra Records, which is less than 3 minutes long. How much did that sell for? Was that higher or lower than Kim Weston?
Well, every good Northern Soul tune is less than 3 minutes long. Motown stuff in general isn't what commands the high prices. Mm-hmm. So this is on a smaller label. So I'm going to say higher.
It is higher, Tim. It's £1,091.
Yikes.
Volumes Ain't Going to Give You Up on Karen Records. Now, is that higher or lower than Ted Wilson?
Well, I'm not able to use my non-Motown logic there because that's the same as the last one. Again, it's an independent. Lower. Let's calm things down. I reckon that went for lower.
No, it went for more. It went for £3,450. Next up, Magic Touch, Melbourne on Kent Select. This was given away at the 100 Club All-Nighter for free. How much is a copy of Magic Touch going to set you back?
So that was the Kent. Kent is a really good reissue label. So that will have been, I guess, a mid-80s release. So I'd like, because that's not an authentic original 60s pressing, I'm going to say lower.
It is lower.
Yes.
Yeah, £600.
Oh, bargain.
And the last one is You Don't Know Boy by The Attractions on Junebug. This clocks in at 2 minutes 40. Not a lot, is it?
I would say the shorter the better, so I'm going to say higher.
It is high. It's £1,276. Craig, thank you so much for that. And do check out his Northern Soul radio show on D-Light, which is 10 to midnight on Fridays.
Why is it that the Northern Soul singles that we get in my shop are never worth more than about 25 quid?
I couldn't tell you. They're out there, though, Tim. Join us next week for more Adventures in Vinyl, where we will be joined by Martin Moskrop from A Certain Ratio, who is going to be talking about his record collection, his history with music, and the new album, ACR Loco.
It's very exciting. I want to prime listeners to get ready to drool at the concept that existed back then in Manchester in the early 80s of record shops that sold entirely American cutout deleted records for not much money. And if you can imagine now being transported back to there, I think a lot of listeners would, you know, think they've died and gone to heaven. So yeah, that's next time on We
Buy
Records.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Cinemortuary podcast.
Well, anyway, you know, we're talking about Werner Herzog now, aren't you? Who's a rule breaker, Wilson.
Yeah. His version of Tom and Jerry was a bit weirder.
Yes, now that I would pay to see.
It's just Tom with a potato masher just hammering Jerry for an hour and a half into absolute dust and pulp. And then takes his own life at the end by sticking his head in the microwave. Thanks, Werner Herzog. Cheers for that.
Pretty Fly, a 90s nostalgia podcast.
I actually never had a Nintendo 64. One of my best friends did, though. So he was particularly good at it, and I was particularly shit at it. So I was not much chop when it came to GoldenEye. I was usually the fourth friend. I was the one that everyone peeked on. They'd like watch my screen. They'd know exactly where I'm respawning. They all learn the spawns. And like I just pop up and I'd be dead in like 10 seconds before I could get a gun.
Yeah, we had a guy like that in the crew. His name was Alan. So yeah, we used to roast Alan big time.
Yeah, so I'm Alan in that situation.
Ask us about Loom. A point-and-click podcast.
Particularly during the King's Quest, Police Quest, Space Quest games. Mm. I think Ronga was quoted, I'm para-quoting because I can't remember the exact quote, but it's at the point where like you'd be too scared to do anything in Sierra games, where because you're like, you'll walk off a path and you'll die, you'll go onto a screen and suddenly Medusa comes out and turns you to stone.
Sounds like playing Prince of Persia. The original, that was like taking the life into your hands.
Yeah. But then like, the idea being that you'd be too scared to experiment because you'll die and you'll have to be constantly saving.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.